Should I? Please be seated. Shall we begin?
Om Sahana Bhavatu, Sahanao Bhunaktu, Sahavhiryam Karavavahai, Tejasvinavadhitamastu, Mavidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi.
Very good. Welcome back. We're in the midst of chapter 18, final chapter of Bhagavad Gita. We'll begin with some recitation. Repeat after me, please.
Dhrityaya dharayate, dhrityaya mana pranendriya kriyaha, mana pranendriya yogena vyavicharanya, yogena vyavicharanya. Dhritasaparta sattviki, yayatu dharma karma kamhartan, yayatu dharma kamhar, dhritya dharayate arjuna, dhritya dharayate, prasangena palakangshi, prasangena palakangshi. Dhriti saparta rajasi, dhriti rajasi, yaya swapnam bhayam shokam, yaya swapnam visharam maramevacha, visharam navi munchati durmedha, navi munchati dhriti saparta tamasi, dhriti saparta sukham twidanim trividham, sukham twidhani shrinu me bharatarshabha, shrinu me. There's a typo here. Abhyasad ramate yatra, yatra dukantam, yatra dukantam cha, Abhyasad ramate yatra, abhyasad dukantam chani gacchati, yataragre vishamiva, yataragre hariname mritopamam, hariname tatsukam satvikam proktam. Atma buddhi prasarajam, atma buddhi prasarajam, vishayendriya samyogad, vishayendriya yattaragre mritopamam, yattaragre pariname vishamiva, pariname tatsukam rajasam smritam, tatsukam yaragre chanubandhe cha, yaragre chanubandhe cha sukham mohanam atmanah, nidralasya pramarotham, nidralasya tatthama samudahritam, natarasti prativyam va, natarasti devi deveshu vapunaha, devi deveshu
Satvam prakriti jair muktam. Satvam. Yadebhisyatribhirgunaihi. Brahmana kshatriya visham. Brahmana. Shudranam chaparantapa. Shudran. Karmani pravibhaktani. Karma. Swabhava prabhavairgunaihi. Swabhava prabhavairgunaihi. Shamodamastapa shaucham. Shamodamastapa shaucham. Kshantirajavamevacha. Kshantiraj. Jnanam vijnanam astikyam. Jnanam vijnanam. Brahma karma swabhavajam. Shauryam tejo dhritir dakshyam. Yuddhe chapya palayanam. Yuddhe chapya. Danam ishvara bhavascha. Danam ishvara. Kshatram karma swabhavajam. Kshatram swabhavajam. Krishi goraksha vanijyam. Krishi goraksha. Vaishya karma swabhavajam. Vaishya. Paricharyatmakam karma. Shudrasyapi swabhavajam. Shudrasyapi swabhavajam. Good. You can see the next topic coming, turning to the four varnas, four so-called castes. But we are at the end of another sequence of sutras where we've seen this threefold analysis in terms of sattva, rajas, and tamas, three gunas, and this threefold analysis applied to a great variety of human traits, personality traits. We saw the three kinds, that threefold analysis applied to jnana, wisdom, applied to buddhi, the quality of mind and intellect, applied to karta, the agent of action, applied to dhriti, intent, fortitude, and applied to karma, three kinds of karma. Very important discussion as we've concluded all of that. And we have one more left in that long list. Actually, that list actually began back in chapter 17. This threefold analysis we're going through now began in chapter 17 and now is concluding in chapter 18. The last topic we have is the three kinds of sukha, three kinds of happiness, or three kinds of happiness. Before we proceed, though, let's return to an observation we made last week and make it a little bit more clear. The significance of this threefold analysis in terms of sattva, rajas, and tamas. You'll recall that the ancient worldview was that everything that existed was a result of these three gunas. Everything that exists manifests these three gunas. I've said before that it's the equivalent to our modern worldview of the world consisting of matter and energy. Today we see the world through that lens, through that model, looking at everything in terms of matter and energy. In ancient times, they saw it in terms of these three gunas, sattva, rajas, tamas, which means everything that exists is a product of all three. Very important point. There's nothing that exists which is based on one and only one. There's nothing that exists that excludes any one of those. Everything in Jagat, this entire world. In fact, one of the words that describe Jagat, the universe, is Trigunatmakam, the universe consisting of three gunas. This is very significant because it means if everything consists of three gunas, are you and I included in everything or not? We're included in everything. Therefore, you and I consist of three gunas. There's no one who's purely sattvika. There's no one who's purely tamasa. every one of us is a combination of these three gunas. But since we are engaged in a life of spiritual growth, obviously what we want to do is shift the balance. We shift the balance first from being predominantly tamas to predominantly rajas, and we shift the balance from predominantly rajas to predominantly sattvika. But bear in mind that all three of these remain in us throughout our lives, and which leads to a different model. You may have a model of these three being independent and separate, and that's not an accurate way of looking at it. If we're all a combination of all three, we can't see them in three batches. You can't think of people and things and say that's tamasic, that's right, or food. Some people will do that with foods and other things. Oh, that's tamasic. Oh, that's rajasic. Everything is a combination. So much better then to see all of everything in the world consisting of three gunas. Instead of seeing them in three categories, why not see them being on a continuum? Where at the far left or the poor side of the continuum is tamas, in the middle, rajas, and at the high end, sattvaguna. To see them on a continuum like this is much more accurate, because what it shows is wherever someone or something is on this continuum, it's a blend of all three. At a point here, you'd say it's predominantly tamas, with a little bit of rajas, and almost no sattva, almost no sattva. And way up here, you'd say it's predominantly sattva with some rajas and almost no tamas, almost no. There's a little bit in each. To see it on a continuum like this is so descriptive when we're talking about our natures. So we just finished this long, or we're finishing now, this long sequence describing personality traits in terms of these three gunas. To look at your intellect in terms of the three gunas. So someone whose intellect is inclined to worldly accomplishments would fall someplace in the middle. Someone whose intellect inclines them towards lots of damaging, harmful things would be down at this end of the scale. Someone whose intellect inclines them towards spiritual activities would be up at the high end of the scale. But bear in mind, even someone up at that high end of the scale still has some tamas and rajas. Similarly, that person who is, you know, the person running around with a gun trying to kill people still has some rajas and sattva. See it on a continuum. And in our last class, we saw a very nice comparison to the worldview of psychology. Worldview of psychology has it that there's such a, by the way, this is only in psychology, where they say some people are normal. And we'll put that in quotation marks, because what is normal, I have no idea. Normal is what everyone else is like. You know, think about it. If you were born in a world where everyone had three arms, you would be abnormal, right? If you were born in a world where everyone had three arms, they'd all say, what's wrong with you? What happened to your third arm? Oh, I didn't get born with one. You would be abnormal. So normal is a very poor way of saying conventional. And that's wouldn't that be a better word? Conventional. So I would suggest that we get rid of that word altogether and say conventional. Therefore, conventional behavior is rajasic behavior. It's behavior aimed towards promoting one's own welfare and that of your family, getting more stuff, acquiring more stuff, having more fun, the usual kind of focus on pleasure in life and security, etc. Conventional life. Then, from a psychological standpoint, normal, on the low end of normal, is something that we would call mental illness.
We suggested in our last class that someone running around with a gun could very well be mentally ill. You know, what is it that drives people to do really harmful things? They're not right. They're not normal. They're not conventional in the way they think, in the way they see the world around them. That's why they're running around with guns and doing all kinds of harmful things. So chances are many such people are suffering from some kind of mental illness. So in a prior class then, we said that these tamasic personality traits look like pathology, look like forms of mental illness, or what psychologists today would call forms of mental illness. Then we said that a great number of personality traits, rajasic personality traits, are normal, they're conventional. But then we said, okay, but we can do better than that. We can do better than that. Remember the example I gave? If you're raising children and they come home with C's on their report card and they say, hey, C's are average, everyone gets a C, is that okay with mom and dad? No way. Because mom and dad know this child can do better than that. Well, that message applies to every one of us in this room. We can do better than this. Therefore, and this is where psychology doesn't do so well. Psychology deals a lot with helping people go from mental illness towards what is normal or conventional. Psychology then leaves you there. Perhaps we could say that spiritual life picks up where psychology leaves off and takes us, if psychology takes someone from a condition of mental illness to a state that we would call, quote, normal, we could then suggest that spiritual life takes us from a condition we would call normal or conventional. Since we can do better than that, let us do better than that, leading us to a life of spiritual growth, primarily sattvika. So nice to see these three in terms of a continuum instead of three groups or three piles. It's not an accurate way at all. And we'll see that in today's class once again, where everything is a combination of the three, but one is predominant. All right, with that introduction, we have one last personality trait to apply this threefold analysis to, and that's a trait, not personality trait, sukha. Means happiness, means an activity of a life. Well, it'll define actually what sukha is. Three kinds of sukha, three kinds of happiness available in life. Let's see how Sri Krishna treats this topic. Sukham tvidanim trividam, sukham tvidanim. Shunume bharatarshabha, shunume bharatarshabha. Abhyasar hramate yatra, abhyasa. Dhukantam chani gacchati. Sukham tu idanim. You have to break the words up. Idanim, now. Now, sukham tu, but on the other hand, sukha means happiness, so he's introducing sukha, the next topic here. Sukha is trividham. Threefold of three kinds, sattvika, rajasa, tamasa. This verse is introducing the topic. And he says to Arjuna, O Bharatarshaba, O mightiest of India, Shrinu, Suno, listen to whom? Me, listen to me. Listen to me, O Krishna, Krishna is speaking to Arjuna. Sri Krishna says, O Bharatarshava, O mightiest of India, please listen to me idanim, now, as I describe trividham sukham, the three kinds of sukha. And what does Sri Krishna mean by sukha? Abhyasat ramate yatra. It's that yatra through which ramate, one revels or one becomes happy, through which you become happy, abhyasat, from, can't translate it as practice, from the experience, abhyasa, from an experience, ramate yatra, in which you become happy, through the experience. So sukha here is described as an experience which makes you happy or pleased. And further, he says, dukkha antam cha nigacchati cha, and it is that which nigacchati, takes you out, extracts you. Extracts you from what? Dukkha, dukkham. Actually, instead of leads you. Nigacchati, it leads one, dukkha antam, to the anta of dukkha, to the end of suffering. So ramate, it creates pleasure, and dukkantam nigacchati, and leads you out of suffering. This is Sri Krishna's definition of sukha, and he says to Arjuna, Srinu, listen now as we discuss the threefold, trividham sukham, the three kinds of sukha. So first will come the sattvika sukha. Yattaragrevishamiva. Yattaragrevish pariname mritopamam pariname tatsukam satvikam proktam tatsukam atma buddhi prasarajam atma buddhi. And these verses are wonderful. These are worth remembering because their description is so vivid and wonderful. So, sattvikam proktam, in the second line, tat sukham sattvikam, tat, that, sukham, that happiness, that experience of happiness is sattvikam proktam. Is proktam called sattvikam? Well, what kind of experience is called sattvika? Yat tad agre, yat tad, that which, agre, at the beginning, initially. Initially, visham, Eva, visha is poison. Eva means just like. That which seems like poison at first, pariname, and then later on, after undergoing some change, pariname, amrita upamam, it becomes like nectar. It becomes equivalent to nectar. Amrita upamam, equivalent to nectar. It starts out being like poison, and later on, it's like nectar. And he says that this is atma buddhi prasarajam. This is which gives rise to atma buddhi and atma prasada. Atma buddhi, one's own intelligence, and atma prasada, one's own blessings. This blesses you with prasada, peace, quiet, calmness. This blesses you with calmness and blesses you with intelligence. This sattvika sukha is that which gives you intelligence and peace, and it is that, and the interesting part, that which is like poison at first and like nectar later on. What in the world is this? Well, it's actually brilliant. I can think of several examples. What was I thinking about before? Oh, when I was quite a bit younger and not at all in good shape, I decided that I would take up running for exercise. This was in the 1970s. It was kind of a craze in this country. New fad. Everyone is jogging. So hey, let me jog. So I get some running shoes, and I go out. I was living in California, beautiful day. So I go out and run, and I start jogging slowly along a beautiful path. And in about a half, not even half a mile, I feel like I'm going to die. My lungs are burning. I felt weak. My limbs felt weak. I felt dizzy, lightheaded, out of air, gasping for breath. Mike, this is exercise? This is supposed to make you feel good, right? Exercise is meant to make you feel good. I felt horrible. I felt like I was going to die. I persisted. Next time it wasn't quite so painful. And after a few weeks and months, I could do it a little bit more comfortably. And in about a half a year, I started to enjoy it. And from that day on, I have gotten consistent exercise almost every day, at least every other day. I don't run as much as I used to, but I'm out here for walks almost, in fact, in this kind of weather, once or twice a day. I'll be outside enjoying the beautiful trails back here. Exercise is a great example because it's something that's not terribly pleasant when you first undertake it. But look, if you don't exercise, what is the consequence? A nice American English saying when they warn you, use it or lose it. Excellent. Use it or lose it. And we're talking about your lungs. We're talking about your heart. We're talking about your life. Use it or lose it. Now, that exercise can be uncomfortable at first, but it becomes something extremely pleasant. Not only does the exercise itself become pleasant, look how it improves the quality of your life. The point is very clear. If you're not willing to undergo some small suffering for the sake of improving your lifestyle and health, then you're doomed to premature death, is what doctors will tell you. Doctors will tell you that in fact, if doctors were honest, you know, they tell you all the different causes for death. You know, they say, you know, heart problems are way up there and cancer is way up there, all of this. But the two most common, probably the two leading causes of death, which we don't think about enough, are automobile accidents and lifestyle-related illnesses. Lifestyle-related illness means if we're overweight, if we're not exercising, if we're not eating proper food, it kills us, and we don't even think about it. So what kind of pleasure, if we've stayed now with exercise and food, that you might argue, well, I want to enjoy my life, so therefore I sure don't want to go out and exercise, like Swamiji said, with his lungs burning and he's aching all over the place. I don't want to do that. Besides, I like eating all this fatty, sweet food, so I want to enjoy my life. So if you enjoy a life eating poor foods and not exercising, how much life will you live? And what will be the quality of that life? So it's pretty clear that a commitment to a healthy life is vishameva at the beginning. It's difficult. But padiname, as it undergoes change, amrita upamam, it becomes like nectar. So many valuable things in life are like that. Difficult at the beginning, a tremendous blessing later on. How about your parts of your education? Now, many of you may have really enjoyed your studies. Not necessarily. A funny anecdote I can share with you. When I started learning Sanskrit, I hated it. I admit. It was tough. It was, first of all, I had come up in college as an engineer. Believe it or not, I had finished my high school and college educations without once taking a foreign language. There was no foreign language requirement. So what was my first foreign language? That's right. Sanskrit was my first foreign language. And then a complicating factor is, can I even read the script? So I have to learn to read the script and then start, you know, like a kindergarten, you know, and all the way through. And then, by the way, that's the easy part. You know, people talk about, oh, Swamiji, how did you learn Sanskrit? You know, the script and all of it. If there's anything that's easy about Sanskrit, it's the script. Everything else is hard. The grammar and vocabulary are amazing. The complexity of the grammar is more than Latin and ancient Greek. Latin has 6 cases, Sanskrit has 8. Latin has masculine and feminine. Sanskrit has masculine, feminine, and neuter. Latin has has singular and plural, as does English. Sanskrit has singular, dual, and plural. And that applies, all of this applies not just to nouns and adjectives, but applies to verbs and participles. Sanskrit has undoubtedly the most complicated grammar of any known language. And I had no inclination to study language. Think of that. And yet, I'm telling you, I didn't enjoy it. I felt intimidated. I felt overwhelmed. I didn't enjoy the process of learning the language. Vishamiva. It was. For me, it was. I persisted. Why? The answer is pretty clear. In the scriptures, scriptures happen to be in Sanskrit, and in those shastras are such profound, compelling teachings. I knew I needed to have direct access to those scriptures. I persisted. Not month after month, year after year. It took me fully 10 years of study before I was even willing to say, yes, I know Sanskrit. And even then, my knowledge was not great. Even now, now it's great. It's so wonderful. I've been enjoying reading this Padma Purana. And I open it up, and it's like reading English. But now, that's after decades of study. Amrita upamam pariname. Later, it becomes like nectar. And for me, being able to read scriptures, just flipping the pages like you would be reading in your own native tongue, in any language, it is indeed a blessing. I would never have received this blessing if I hadn't persisted early on in the study of Sanskrit. The message is so clear. We better be prepared for some investment of ourselves and be prepared for meeting some difficulties if we want to accomplish anything of value with our lives. I've said in some other classes a little sarcastically, and I apologize for being too sarcastic sometimes, but it's a point worth noting. How would it be to reach the end of your life and look back and say, yes, I lived a comfortable life? Do you really want to end your life like that? Saying, yep, I was comfortable. We just got done discussing how we can do better than that. Well, the way you'll do better than that is by facing these difficulties to pursue something of greater value. So that's clearly what this verse is about. Any other examples? Oh, other examples here. Get one more, a couple more. How about meditation? Many of you struggle with meditation, as I did too. You sit down to meditate, and your mind wanders and wanders and wanders. You sit down tomorrow, your mind wanders and wanders. Sit down the third day, wandering and wandering. You give up. Hey, if you want, meditation is such a vital skill in one's spiritual life. It won't be gained. That skill won't be gained without some significant investment of your effort, and that effort could involve some discomfort. You have to sit for long periods of time, and if your tailbone gets a little sore, well, that's part of the price you pay. By the way, it's okay to sit in a chair to meditate. You don't have to be uncomfortable, but you get the point. The point is very clear. And Sri Krishna, this verse is just lovely in its poetic way of describing it, and by saying it's Vishamiva at the beginning. At the beginning, those sattvika sukhas, those the kind of sukha that is atma buddhi prasarajam, that's a really important word here. The kind of happiness which leads to spiritual growth. What kind of happiness do you want? Do you want the kind of life? I'm sorry. Do you want the kind of happy? Sorry, I'm tripping over my words. You're thinking of a joke. Do you want the kind of sukkah that leads to growth of your waistline? Or the kind of sukkah that leads to spiritual growth? So here in this verse, we see described the kind of sukkah that leads to spiritual growth. It means that in which we have to make an investment of our effort and overcome some difficulties at first. But then, pariname, later on, undergoes a transformation and it becomes amrita upamam. It becomes equivalent to nectar. Beautiful metaphor. And that metaphor is continued in the next verse, talking about rajasa sukha. Vishayendriya samyogad, vishayendriya. Yattaragre mritopamam, yattaragre. Pariname vishamiva, parinha. Tatsukam rajasam smritam, tatsukam. Tat sukham, that sukha, rajasam spritam. That sukha is remembered or considered as being rajasa, rajoguna. What kind of happiness is this? Vishaya indriya samyogat. It comes about samyogat through the connection of indriyas with vishayas. Through the connection of your senses with objects of senses. Indriya is sense organ, vishaya is the object of your senses. So basically through sense enjoyment is what he says here. So rajasa sukha is sukha that arises through sense enjoyment. When you eat something pleasant, when you do something pleasant, this is vishayendriya samyogat, through sensual enjoyment. And it is, of course, that's common knowledge. But now comes the metaphor once again. It is yat tat agre, that which at the beginning, initially, amrita upamam, at the beginning it's like amrita, nectar, pariname, but later, as it undergoes changes, it becomes visham eva. It's ulta, the opposite. So the sattvika sukha started out like visha, poison, and becomes like nectar, amrita, and the rajasa sukha is just the opposite. It starts out pleasant, amrita upama, and later it becomes visha eva. Huh? Enjoyments which start out being pleasant and later become a source of pain and suffering. Well, to go to a very obvious example, food. So every donut you eat, amrita. But later, what does it do to you? And not just do to your waistline, but think of what it's doing to your arteries. As it's clogging your arteries with plaque and predisposing you to this coronary artery disease. Come on, what a great example. This Bhartrahari, this beautiful shlokas he's written in his Vairagya Shataka, he talks about the problems of worldly life. And he had a verse talking about food, and it's really hilarious. He said, the first half of your life, I don't remember the Sanskrit, but the meaning of his verse was this. The first half of your life, you eat food. Second half of your life, food eats you. What an image. Now, there are many, on a more serious note, there are many kinds of happiness which are very pleasant initially, but which have very negative consequences later on. Think about someone who is just really inclined towards enjoyment of the moment. So they go on just buying stuff and doing stuff and enjoying each moment. But then, what about tomorrow? What about retirement? What about what comes later? If you're so focused on present happiness, that you ignore the future, aren't you dooming yourself to future suffering? This is common wisdom, but how beautifully expressed in these verses. So sattvika sukha means some suffering at first for some later gain. Rajasa sukha means some present happiness, but the consequence of which is later suffering. Every day we make these choices. Why don't we see one more? We better see one more, and then we'll have a little more to talk about. So I was about to say, every morning you make choices, but the choice is not a twofold choice. The choice is a threefold choice. So let's see, what is that third category? The tamasa sukha. Yadagre chanubandhe cha, yadagre chanubandhe. Sukham mohanam atmanaha, sukham mohanam. Nidralasya pramarottam, nidralasya pramarottam. Tat tamasam, that is tamasa. Udahritam, it's given as an example. All right, what is tamasa? Yat agre, that which at the beginning, anubandhecha, and as things go along, at the beginning and later, at the beginning and middle and end, at all times in connection with it, that which at the beginning and following, that sukha which at the beginning and at in the middle and at the end, that which is mohanam atmanaha, atmanaha for oneself, it is mohanam, causes delusion. That happiness which causes delusion. What do you mean? Well, he continues. Nidra, alasya, pramada, uttam. Uttam, that which gives rise to. That which gives rise to what? Nidra, sleep. Alasya, laziness. Pramada, delusion, ignorance, wrong thinking, that which puts you on a wrong track. These kinds of sukha are tamasa. Now, let's give some more specific examples. Clearly, sattvika sukha is that which leads to spiritual growth. Go right back to our continuum. Sattvika sukha leads to spiritual growth. Rajasa sukha is the conventional stuff. Enjoy today and suffer tomorrow. Isn't that conventional wisdom? People do that all the time. Enjoy today and you deal with consequences tomorrow. And tamasa sukha is that which makes you ill. Literally, that which makes you ill. You know, with regard to food, I guess the best example of this is drinking alcohol. Now, alcohol is a poison, isn't it? Alcohol is a poison. To me, it's very odd that it's culturally acceptable to drink small amounts of poison. It just seems very, very peculiar that in a social context, everyone thinks it's a great idea to drink small amounts of very expensive poison. Alcohol is poison. You can't argue with that. And if you drink a little bit, then the effects are less. If you drink more, the effects are more. If you drink enough, you're dead from alcohol poisoning. And some people die from alcohol poisoning. Some people die, you know, from alcohol-related illnesses as well. And it's a poison. What a great example of an enjoyment which makes you sick. Any kind of enjoyment which makes you sick is a tamasa sukha. And you can think of other examples. Pornography would be an example of that, or so many, you know, use of drugs, any kind of mind-altering drugs, all of this tamasa, because it leads to illness. So how clear is it to put it on this continuum and see whatever experience you have in life is going to fall someplace on that continuum. If it falls way to the left, that experience can make you sick. If it falls way to the right, that experience can elevate you and lead you further on your path of spiritual growth. If that experience lies someplace in the middle, it leaves you in that conventional state, that conventional worldly state. Now, every morning we get up and we make choices. Each choice is going to be to choose some activity or something which is going to fall someplace on that continuum. Here's something really worth noting. Every choice you make counts. Every choice you make has a consequence. Too often, we give ourselves permission to do unhealthy, wrong, or somehow immoral things or not good things. We give ourselves permission saying, well, I'll just do it a little bit. We make some excuse. But every time we make the wrong choice, we suffer. Period. On the other hand, every time you choose to do something which lifts you up, you are blessed. What is it that prevents us from making better decisions? We're all intelligent people. Why is it that we don't always use our best judgment? Perhaps we're lazy in some sense. You come home, it's a common experience. You come home from a long day at work, and you just want to relax. All right. Tired. And I can understand how tired many of you are. You work long hours. You come home from a long day of work, tired. You just want to relax. Sit down in your living room. Click. All right. Click, click. Click, 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 click. You're watching TV, surfing through all these ridiculous channels. Now, this is a great example. Watching mindless entertainment on television, is that sattvika sukha? Certainly not. Is it rajasa sukha? Perhaps. Is it tamasa sukha? If you're just doing it to dull your mind, if you're just doing it as an escape, as just some, isn't that escapism is not healthy? Wouldn't that be a tamasa sukha? If you're using television like a drug, some people come home from work and they pour themselves a big drink of poison, alcohol. And maybe you choose not to do that. Wonderful. But click, click. It's sort of, it's not as bad as alcohol, but it's the equivalent. You're numbing your mind. Instead of numbing your mind with alcohol, you're numbing your mind with all this network programming. It's ridiculous. This is an example of a tamasa sukha that is very easy to fall into. You have a choice to make. So when you come home tired, and you do, and I know that you come home tired, can you not find a healthier way of relaxing? That's just it, a healthier way of relaxing. How about going out on your back porch with a nice book and some iced tea instead of a drink? You know, there are, the point is, the choice is yours. We're all intelligent enough to make the right choices. But sometimes we give ourselves permission with these excuses like, oh, I'm too tired. No more excuses. We can do better than that if we stop giving ourselves room to make those excuses, if we decide we're going to make the best choices we can at each point. By doing that, you will avoid all tamasasukha. You will avoid much rajasasukha. And you will be blessed with so much sattvika sukha. And this will definitely lift you up in the life of spiritual growth. All right. So with this verse, we conclude this topic of the threefold sukha. And we move now into the next topic, which surprisingly shifts. We've been going through this threefold analysis now for dozens of verses. And now suddenly we're going to be talking about the four varnas, the four so-called castes. What kind of connection is that? Let's see this first verse, and then that'll open up a discussion. Oh, did I skip one? Oh. Yeah. I skipped one. Exactly. I'm clicking like a TV set. There we go. Thank you. All right. So, and nice. It's actually one more. This verse summarizes this discussion of the threefold analysis. So we'll get the summary verse before we continue. Thank you. Natarasti prativyam va natarasti. Devi Deve Shuva Punaha Devi Satvam Prakriti Jair Muktam Yade Bhisyatri Bhir Gunaihi Yade Bhisyatri. The basic meaning of this verse, before we see it word by word, is there's nothing in this world that is free from the three gunas. Meaning everything in this world is someplace on this continuum. And the way the verse says is prithivyam, on the earth, and I'm going to jump around just to get the words nicely. Prithivyam, on this earth, va divi, or in the sky, in the heavens, deveshu va punaha, or among the gods, wherever you go, natadasti, there is not anything. There is not any what? Natarasti sattvam. Careful now. Sattva has different meanings. The word sat, the word sattva comes from the word sat, familiar word to you all, meaning truth or reality. Sattva, the twa affix makes it an abstract noun, so it can have many meanings. The guna sattva is just one of many meanings. Here, sattva means existent thing. And you go look it up in your dictionary, you'll find there are many meanings for sattva, one of which is a guna, another of which is existent thing. In our Yoga Sutra class, we saw sattva used many times for mind. So be careful, words have different meanings. Here, sattva means existent thing. Natarasti sattvam, there is no existent thing which is muktam, free. No sattvam, which is muktam. No thing, which is muktam, free. Free from what? Ebihi, tribihi, gunaihi. We have to connect all these words. Yad ebihi, you see that? Ebihi, from these. What these? Tribihi, from these three. From these three what? Gunaihi, from these three gunas. Ebihi, tribihi, gunaihi, muktam. Free from these three gunas. Natarasti sattvam. There's absolutely nothing. No thing which is free from these three gunas. Prithivyam, here on the earth. Deviva, or in the heavens, Deveshuva, or among the gods, there is nothing free or independent of these three gunas, syat, could be. There's nothing that could be free from these three gunas which are prakriti jaihi, born of prakriti, born of nature. everything that exists is a manifestation of these three gunas. Everything is an expression to one extent or the other of all three, or to go back to our other metaphor, everything lies someplace on this continuum, is what the verse says. So I guess the closing message before we leave the subject matter behind is every decision you make is going to be targeting an experience someplace on that continuum, and the choice is yours. You can shoot high, sattva, or set your aims low, and the consequences are very clear. Every choice you make counts. Every choice has consequences. We to give ourselves an excuse to take the lower path is not in our own best interests. Okay, now we can proceed to the next subject matter. Brahmana kshatriya visham, brahmana shudranam chaparantapa, shudranam karmani pravibhaktani, swabhava prabhavairgunaihi, swabhava. So, suddenly, we're talking about the four varnas, the four so-called castes, the Brahmana, Kshatriya. Vish is Vaishya. Vish is a short word for Vaishya. And Shudra. Now, why does Sri Krishna introduce any discussion first about these four groups? We're talking about personality traits. And it's worth noting that according to Sri Krishna, one's varna, I hesitate to use the word caste. This is a complicated, this is a big topic and a big issue, obviously. The word caste is actually, you realize, of course, the word caste is not a Sanskrit word. It's not a Hindi word. You'll be very surprised to know what language the word caste comes from. Few of you may know this. It's very surprising. The word caste is a Portuguese word. Honestly, it came from the Portuguese settlers on the west coast of India, Goa, etc. Apparently, they brought that word with them to describe these four varnas. Varna here means group. Four groups of people. Now, we all know that the caste system has been a controversial problem in Hinduism. And let's be very clear what Sri Krishna's position on this so-called caste problem is. He says, according to Sri Krishna, caste is not determined by birth. Can I say that again? According to Sri Krishna, caste is not determined by birth. Period. Full stop. We've discussed this before, long ago. How long ago? Years? Way back in chapter 4. How many years ago was that? And 2, 3 years ago? 4 years, 3 years ago? So way back in chapter 4, Chatur Varanyam Maya Srishtam. This Chatur Varanyam, this system of four varanas, this system of four so-called castes, was Maya Srishtam, created by me, Sri Krishna says. It was created by me, how? Guna Karma Vibhagashaha. Vibhagashaha, according to divisions, according to which divisions, Guna and Karma. Guna, quality, Karma, activity, behavior. So Sri Krishna says in that first half of the verse, he says, these four groups were created by me according to Janma, according to family, according to Guna and Karma, according to your inner qualities, and according to your behavior. Clear enough? Now, there's no doubt that there have been many wrong things taught about this, but what Sri Krishna says is very clear. What the Bhagavad Gita has to say is very clear, that these four varnas, these four groups, are determined according to guna and karma. This verse says, excuse me, This verse says, Brahmana, Kshatriya, Visham, Shudranam cha, for each of the four, all four. For the Brahmanas, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, and Shudras. For all of these, Karmani, Pravibhaktani, for all of these, there are karmani, actions. Actions which are pravibhaktani, which are different than several. Individual actions. Different kinds of behaviors. For each of these four groups, there are different kinds of activities, different kinds of behaviors, which are swabhava, prabhavaihi, gunaihi, which result from the gunas, the qualities, which are swabhava prabhava, which are born of one's own nature. So according to one's own nature, there are different behaviors born. According to one's, notice these words, according to one's own nature, I'm sorry, according to one's gunas, there are different karmas. Isn't that what he said in chapter 4? Guna, karma, Vibhagashaha. And that same thing is being taught here. That is, a person has different qualities, gunas, and according to those qualities come your karma, comes your behavior. According to your qualities come your behavior. And these different qualities can be associated with the four varnas. Do you remember we did this long, long ago? Since we're doing this threefold analysis in terms of sattva, rajas, tamas, shall we do that now with regard to these four varnas? We did this 3 years ago, maybe forgotten, or maybe you weren't here at that time. Let's do it now. You can see the connection between these four varnas and the three gunas. It's also on a continuum, but this chart doesn't really help. So Brahmana refers to that group of teachers, priests, etc. Those who are not involved in any kind of commerce. Okay, so that group of Brahmana, teachers, priests, etc. Do Brahmanas have tamoguna? We just got done saying that everything, everyone, must have all three gunas. But now we would presume that there would be a minimum amount of tamas in a Brahmana, and there would be perhaps a prevalence of sattva guna. So suppose we define a Brahmana in terms of the three gunas as someone who has, if we have all three gunas, then which one is in first place? For the Brahmana, first place would be sattva guna. Second place would be rajas, rajoguna. And third place, tamas, tamoguna. Good. Now, a kshatriya, the leaders, the warriors, leaders, warriors is enough. Politicians. Except in India, I'm not sure it works that way. You know, we won't get into that. Politics is a bad topic just now. All right. So these kshatriyas, to take on those leadership responsibilities, would have to be more active. So you wouldn't be surprised if we were to say that rajas was predominant, but then presumably they're leading us in the right direction, they're helping us. You know, the ancient vision of a politician is someone who had the welfare of people at mind. So we would say, then, therefore, sattva would be in second place and tamas in third. And then we come next to the vaishyas. Vaishya would include merchants, Vaishya would include farmers, or Vaishyas. All right. So, farmers and merchants are very active. They have lots of work to do. So, we would expect Rajas to be in first place. But their work is not for the sake of the public. Their work is for their own sake and that of their families. So we can't put sattva in second place. We would say tamas in second place, leaving a minimum of sattva. And the final group, shudra. So shudra, the workers, if you don't tell a worker to do anything, what do they do? Nothing. Correct? If a worker has nothing to do, they just don't do anything. So, obviously, Thomas. And then, if they do something, is it for their own sake or out of the welfare of mankind? If they do anything at all, you know, if they get up and work, it's so they can get pay and use a pay for themselves. So definitely we have to put rajas in second place and a minimum of sattva. Now notice we have just defined these three groups entirely in terms of guna, in terms of their qualities. And the nature of their qualities then is going to carry over into their karma, into their actions. So according to guna, that will determine karma. Your qualities determine your behavior. Where does birth fit into this? Where does family fit into this? It doesn't at all. So the Bhagavad Gita's vision of these four castes is very different. Now, this is not to say that a jati-based, a family-based caste system has most certainly existed for a long time, and it's fraught with all kinds of problems and abuses. Thank goodness it's going away today. But two observations. One is, it's clear that the Bhagavad Gita does not ascribe to that birth-based system of the four vanaras, four castes. And that leaves us with one more question. We'll talk about just for a few minutes before we conclude the class. And that is, if the Bhagavad Gita does not teach that harmful, discriminative form of casteism, where did it come from? Where did these abuses come from? Where did it come where people were limited by the family into which they were born and society wouldn't give them any freedom at all? Where did this come from? Can you show me any scripture that says we should discriminate against people based on their birth? You won't find any scriptural support for caste-based discrimination. Yet, caste-based discrimination has existed and does exist in some parts of India. In village India, you still see some of these problems. So if it didn't come from scripture, where did it come from? Pretty clear? It came from people. That is, people with their own agendas, people with some deliberate misinterpretation of scripture for the sake of perhaps serving their own selfish needs and wants, etc. This happens in every religion is subject to this kind of distortion. And just, as long as we're talking about this, one last observation: how horribly this caste problem has been used to define Hinduism so inappropriately. And just, this is a pet peeve, so give me just 2 minutes to share it with you. If you were to open up a child's social studies book to the chapter on Hinduism, and I think in seventh grade in this country, or some fifth or seventh grade, they'll get a unit on Asian culture, and they'll get a chapter on India, and perhaps a discussion about Hinduism. And what I find absolutely shocking is that almost every one of those textbooks will characterize Hinduism as a religion that practices the caste system, which is to say that these authors make caste a defining characteristic of Hinduism. And that is so horribly wrong. The caste system is part of the religion, no one can deny. It's a problem no one can deny. But to say that it's somehow fundamental to Hinduism and defines Hinduism is ridiculous. The counterexample I would give is if they were to argue many Hindus have practiced discriminatory caste practices, well, many Christians practice slavery. It's a fact. Many, many Christians practice slavery, even in this country. Christians who went to church, this is not to put down any group, but to make a point. Christians who would go to church every week, every Sunday, they would own slaves. Shall we say that Christianity is defined as a religion that practices slavery? No one would dream of saying such a thing. Well, to me, it seems equivalent. You know, to say that Hinduism is defined as a religion that practices casteism is equivalent to saying that Christianity is a religion that practices slavery. Slavery is awful. Discrimination in the name of caste is awful. But slavery does not define Christianity, and most certainly casteism does not define Hinduism. It's a fact. It exists. But it's not a defining fact. The problems of casteism, then, are a problem not of Hinduism, a problem of Hindus. Different, right? Hinduism, the scriptural-based religion, does not promote this problem. However, certain individuals might propagate this problem. Anyway, clear enough. When we meet next time, we're going to then see Sri Krishna's analysis of these four groups, these four so-called castes, according to their karma. So the gunas are up on the board right now, the qualities of each of the four up on the board now. What would be then their karma? What is their behavior? That's what we'll see in our next class. All right. Before we conclude, a couple of quick announcements. This coming Friday, we have our Hindu Dharma course, which we'll meet here. Friday at 7 p.m. Please.